Welcome to Monday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Glad that you are with us. Hope you enjoyed the taste of spring that we had over the weekend. Of course, a little cooler now this week, but it was nice to see what may be ahead. In today's show, we continue our discussions with North Dakota Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth. Today, a former Teacher of the Year, Sheila Peterson, joins us to talk about how mental health shows up many ways in schools, from stress to disengagement to behavior challenges and crisis moments, and the conversation that explores what's working in North Dakota schools and communities, families, and with educators to help students feel seen, heard, and supported. Welcome to this Monday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're talking about student mental health and behavioral support, what it looks like day to day in schools right here in North Dakota, and what helps. North Dakota data says that a significant share of students report persistent distress, and many who are struggling don't consistently get the help that they need. Schools can't do it alone, but they're a critical front door, building belonging, teaching expectations, spotting warning signs, and connecting families to support. My guests today are two North Dakota Teachers of the Year, Sheila Peterson and Franny Tunseth, and we'll talk about what works from the gym and the classroom to the school-wide systems that help kids stay connected and ready to learn. Sheila and Franny, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'm so excited, Craig.
And one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this discussion today is we have two teachers, one from an urban Bismarck school, so to speak, and then Franny from maybe a smaller school that has a little more of the rural flair to it. And we often talk about the differences of education in North Dakota from bigger schools to smaller schools. So I think that today's discussion will be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And Sheila, if I may, I'd like to visit with you. I want to ask you first, when we talk about student mental health and behavioral support, what does that mean in your daily work? And what do you wish the public understood about the difference between behavior support and a word that we don't like to hear, punishment?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, we always say in education that behavior is a form of communication. And I think the biggest thing that we have to think about is, what is the student trying to tell us? And a lot of times, just the average bear, we don't wake up in the morning and want to be cranky. We don't want to wake up in the morning and throw a fit. We don't want to wake up in the morning and be sarcastic and angry. Lots of things happen to us, and then we respond, right? I teach in a gym. By the end of the day, I'm pretty overstimulated. So at the end of the day, I need the car quiet, and I've been talking all day. You know, and so you think about kids, if we start to look at it from that frame, what is a child trying to communicate with you? One, and I read a book, and I cannot remember the name of the, I think it's called No Drama Discipline. And in the book, like the very first page, it blew my mind, and I've been teaching a long time, but it said, you know, the Greek ethos of punishment is to, or of discipline is to teach, you know? And so when you look at, and that really reframed how I looked at when I worked with students, you know, if I'm going to punish somebody, I even kind of hate to say that, because really it's not about making somebody feel bad. It's about modifying the behavior so the student can be successful. So I think when you look at behavioral supports and behavior and punishment, it really takes that, it's really important that we take a look at, like, why is that behavior happening? And I think as adults, sometimes we forget when we were children too. I think as adults, we forget when we have bad days, right? But if we were to pull back, we understand. You go to your spouse, I'm so sorry. I was like this because, but sometimes we struggle to have that moment, because when it happens with a student, sometimes it can be scary. Sometimes they can catch you off guard with what comes out of their mouth. And so in that moment of startle, or even you might not feel the greatest, you have to be able to stay in that prefrontal cortex and maybe take the pause. That's one thing I have to tell myself all the time. My kids see me go, I'm going to pause for a second. And they look at me. I just want to make sure that I handle this the best that I can.
Franny, as we move forward here, what do you wish the public understood about the difference between behavior support and punishment?
I think Sheila did a really great job of talking about that. I think that there is a distinct difference there. And I do like how Sheila kind of, one of my main things that I talk about too, is that behavior is communication. I just went and had the opportunity to talk with pre-service teachers last week at Mayville State. And that was something that I brought up with those students. We were talking about big behaviors in school, and we were talking about some of the scary and some of the sad things that we see. But I said at the root of the behavior, a student is trying to communicate something. And I think that's where teachers, we come in trying to figure out what are they trying to communicate, and then how do we respond? And a lot of time that's not done in isolation, right? Teachers are a collaborative unit. We're trying to partner with other entities, other professionals, other outside organizations to try and figure out how can we provide wraparound supports to help students out. But with that, we also have a responsibility to make sure that our schools are a safe space. And so I think that's some of the tension that comes in when we're talking about some of the big behaviors that are happening in schools is how do we make school a safe space for all students and then provide those wraparound supports to help students get better with the behavioral and mental challenges that they're dealing with.
I was surprised when I was preparing to visit with you both today, the number of folks who present some stress, some mental health issues, et cetera, in North Dakota schools. So often I think we hear about these issues somewhere else, but they're here today. And I'm very curious, over the past few years, what changes have each of you noticed in the kinds of stress students bring into school? And what does that look like in a classroom or the hallway? Give us some insight into what you experience. Sheila, you can start.
Well, I think anxiety, has been on a rise in a way that I've never seen in my career. And this is my 25th year of being in education. And it used to be like you could kind of identify that this was the kid who was anxious. But now we're seeing it across all spectrums of humans, right? My athletes, my students who are in the theater, my students who are straight A students, it's across the board. It's not like it's picking one student or one subtype, a group of kids. So I think that that's one thing that I've really noticed. The other thing I've noticed, and maybe Franny, you can agree or disagree on this one, but the increase in aggression. You know, I've seen a rapid rise in the amount of kids that go to fighting right away, and good kids. You know, a lot of times you think of kid fights like, oh, that's a horrible kid, right? They're so bad. But I've seen wonderful kids, and just lacking that ability to figure out like what is a big problem, what is a little problem, and then at what level do you respond, right? Sometimes the response to the stressor isn't equal to the situation that had happened. So those are a couple of things that we're seeing, I know, in our buildings lately.
Franny, what have you noticed in the kinds of stress students bring into school?
You know, Craig, I was frantically writing down some notes over here because I was trying to reflect on that. And I think there's been three main types of stress that I've seen in my rural schools and other schools that I've worked at. Number one is an economic and resource stress. And what I'm noticing is that financially things are hard. And that conversation is coming into school from kids too. I have kids saying like, I would love to do XYZ, but we don't have the extra money for that. I would love to participate and go to prom. My parents don't have the extra money for that. I'm worried about my lunch bill. I'm worried about these different things. And that's sad. As a teacher, when you have kids that are having those conversations, and those are adult conversations that they're having, it's heartbreaking. Another thing that I'm seeing is peer social stress. And I think a lot of that comes back to the use of cell phones and technology. I know that's something that Sheila's really tapped into, and I want to dive into that with her. But I've noticed it's really tough in our school right now. I'm so excited that North Dakota is now phone free from bell to bell, and that we've removed cell phones from our schools, because I have seen a complete shift in the way students interact with each other. Before this year, there was a withdrawal. You would walk down the hallways and students wouldn't even be engaging with each other, looking at each other, having conversations. They'd be texting each other from across, well, Snapchatting each other. I'm dating myself a little bit, but Snapchatting each other from across the table instead of having a conversation. And I do think, though, that although we've removed the cell phones and I've seen really great like conversations happening in the classroom, there still is that peer and social stress that's coming into the classroom, and it's kind of leaking in sideways from things that happen outside of our school walls. And then another one, I think, is just that family home stress. I think that our families are just dealing with some really big things right now. And in rural schools specifically, or rural towns specifically, there's lack of wraparound supports, right? We have lack of mental health supports. Our areas are just completely like drenched in just needing additional help. And so I think that we see that coming in too. And the main way that I see it, like Sheila said, is I see we have some very big behaviors that did not occur at the beginning of my schooling, right? Like when I first entered this profession, the behaviors that I'm dealing with now are very different than I dealt with 13 years ago. They're much larger. They can quite frankly be a little bit scarier. Another thing that I see is our students that normally are able to perform very well. There's that withdrawal where like they're dropping out of sports that they've played forever. They are going from straight A's to now failing classes. And so I think this conversation is very needed and it's very important because I think we need to try to critically think about how can we all partner together? And it's not just the school. How can we partner with other agencies to make sure that we're providing the supports our students need to try and remedy some of these things?
And I'll point out that the cell phone ban is true mm-hmm. during school time, but before school yes. and after school, late at night, early in the morning, cell phones are still out there in North Dakota, oftentimes kind of hidden from parents' view, I think sometimes too. Are there warning signs that you both look for that you're trying to recognize earlier, maybe, especially quieter signals like withdrawal, Franny mm-hmm. talked about that, or mm-hmm. or disengagement that might be easy to miss and might be good advice so for some parents and friends mm-hmm. who are listening?
I think there's a couple. I think that emotional warning sign where we start to see students being like persistent sad or like that feeling of hopelessness, you know, some irritability or anger that just kind of seems disproportionate to like what's actually happening. I think those emotional warning signs is a good first thing to look for. I think another one is like sudden behavioral changes. Like if something is completely like a sudden shift in behavior can be one of the most noticeable signs that we see where there's an increase in aggression, increased in defiance, sometimes even like that risk-taking behavior where like, gosh, this just isn't who you are. And all of a sudden you're doing all these things and it can be worrisome. I think too, that withdrawal from friends or activities and things that they once enjoyed is a really clear sign that we need to tap into kids and try and have conversations and figure out what's going on. And then that third one, that academic warning sign, I think that when we have mental health struggles, we frequently see a change in school performance. And so if you're a parent or if you're somebody who cares about a kid, because I think there's lots of people that maybe aren't a parent, Craig, but like are an aunt or an uncle or a godfather, a godparent, and they care about kids. I think that those are some signs that we just need to make sure that we're being proactive rather than reactive about.
I agree with everything that Franny just said, and I was going to say the same things. I think some other things is just noticing the joy. You know, you can feel it, you know, and sometimes you feel it and you wonder if your kid's okay. Ask them if they're okay. Sometimes we, you know, our kids get upset and they are bothered by it. You need to bother them anyways, right? And because kids more than ever are more secretive. They have more ways to be secretive. So it is so scary to me as a parent on the things that I just in my experience of parenting that I found out that I didn't know, right? And so being aware of signs of like some self-harm stuff too. And that's really hard because sometimes I've had so many students that I would have never thought, right? And then you get a message like, hey, just be aware that this is happening. And so just those anxious moments, the scratching, the different things people do when they get anxious, those are also signs. You know, you see that kid scratching their arm a lot or their hands are grabbing a lot and they're trying to hold it together because either they're embarrassed or they don't want somebody to think that they're okay, right? And so normalizing that it's okay, one, to tell somebody you're not okay, but two, you got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. You have to ask them those questions and they're hard. You know, I have a teenager and I have an adult child and it is not easy and you're scared. You don't know what the answer you're going to get when you ask them. You know what your tummy tells you, but.
I think that this is happening at a younger and younger rate as well. And I think a lot of times in the past, we thought like this is a high school problem or like, yeah, sure, maybe a middle schooler. I have a fourth grader and I can tell you this is happening in fourth grade as well. And so I think that as parents too, and as people that care about young children, we just need to know that it's happening at earlier and earlier ages. And we need to be able to engage in those conversations. And my favorite tip is I love to get my daughter in a car because she can't go anywhere once we're in a car. And when we're driving around, like she's kind of hostage. And so like the radio is off and we're just having a conversation. But I think those are some of the most powerful things we can do for our children too, because the more we show up and the more willing we are to have those conversations, even if we're scared of the answer, I think the more they know that we're there and that they can talk to us at any time, even if it's not in a car or a conversation that we've, you know, started, they know that we're there and that they can talk to us.
I'm enjoying my conversation. It's a hard conversation with Sheila Peterson and Franny Tunseth. Both are current and former Teachers of the Year here in North Dakota. Franny and I visit monthly about different topics that have to do with education. We're talking about mental health and behavioral support today here on Main Street. How can parents have that tough conversation? What's the first best question they should ask a little one when they recognize some of the things that you've just talked about? They don't want to burn the bridge, so to speak. They don't want to put up a wall. They don't want to put the child on defense right away. They want to help. So what is that first best question?
So I've had a variety of positions. You know, I've taught physical education, health. I've taught English for a little while, reading strategies. And I spent 1 year working in, you know, an emotional disability classroom. And one of the trainings they sent me to, and the best thing that I could have ever went to, but they just talked a lot about going back 24 hours in their day. You know, you'd have a kid that was escalated, they're upset. And if you go, tell me what's wrong, that's the last thing they're going to do is tell you what's wrong. And in my bad moments, that's 100% what I do with my own kid. What's going on, right? But if I go back, just start going backwards in time. Tell me a little bit, like, what did you have for breakfast? Okay, go through, like, what happened at lunch? Did you have anything happening? You know, and not even asking if something happened, but like, what did you work on? And through that, sometimes those things will kind of unravel on their own. You know, I had a student once, you know, she's, oh my gosh, 20 years ago now, but it was, well, my mom, you know, she had to work a double shift. The person didn't show up for work. And then I had to put my sisters to bed. And then the next morning, my mom wasn't there because she had to go in early. And so I had to get my sisters on the bus and they wouldn't get on the bus. Well, he had gotten in trouble for pushing his sisters at the bus stop. So now he's already escalated because he's in trouble. And then as his day goes on and academics are hard and he didn't have breakfast, you know what I mean? It was just like, it was really easy to see real fast. I'm like, holy, how did you hold yourself together this long, my friend? So that's one thing, trying to get to it another way. I know, like Franny said, going to the, in the car, for me, it's going to the movies with my daughter. For whatever reason, you know, we go to the movies and on the way home from the movie, she melts a little bit. And so it's having that patience. Sometimes you have to be patient and give them that time to let it come out.
Franny, what's your best advice?
Yeah. Well, I think I have a couple. I think my first thing, Craig, is that we need to make sure that we're having conversations as teachers, as parents, as people that care about kids early and often. And it can't just be when something is wrong, right? Like they need to know they can come to us early and often. So I think number one, it needs to start before these things are happening. And we need to just make sure that we're a person they can talk to. But number two, you know, I had a student a couple years ago, something was clearly wrong. And so I sat down next to him and we sat there for almost 45 minutes in silence. And I just let him de-escalate and I had to de-escalate and take some deep breaths too. And after things I could feel, like you can just feel a shift in the environment. And I just said, I'm worried about you. I care about you and I'm here to help. Can we talk about what's going on? And I think approaching it through a way of like, not like a punishment or like, hey, you've been so different and what's going on. And sometimes it's just even in the conversation and the tone that we're having where it is really this proactive, like, I want to be here to help. And I might not have all the answers. I say that to kids all the time. Like, I might not have all the answers and we might need to call and help from somewhere else, but I care about you and I want to try and help. And I want to try and figure out how we can help you. I think it's just being honest with kids. I think more than anything, the thing that I've learned in 13 years, Craig, is it's just so important to be honest with kids and to be vulnerable and be willing to have those conversations no matter how tough they are.
I was surprised to learn too that research suggested, you talk about important people, important adults in people's lives, but not every student has a trusted adult at school. And I reflect back on my childhood and I thought I had plenty of people I could trust. So I was surprised to read this. What do you both do concretely to help students feel known and safe enough to ask for help?
Well, Craig, that makes me so sad to hear. And I know that that's some kids' realities and it makes me so sad. And as educators, I think that it is a wake up call to make sure that we are proactively reaching out to students and that we are letting them know that we can be those people. And so I think that there needs to be a shift in education too. And I know different schools have different things where they will have like lists of students and it's like, hey, let's put a dot next to the kids that we know we have a positive relationship with. And all of a sudden you get to a student that doesn't have any dot. It's like, who is taking that kid and who's making sure they're reaching out to them? So I think that that's a really good reminder for schools that we need to be proactive about making sure every student does feel that way. So I want to thank you for bringing that up. Second of all, I think that one of my core beliefs in education is that we need to know our students as people before we know them as students, right? Like we need to know what are the things that they really enjoy, what are the things that they don't enjoy. And that just comes from conversation. It comes from taking the time to get to talk to our students and get to know them. And sometimes that means that I might not be on pace with my curriculum, but that's okay with me at the end of the day, because more than anything, we're there for our students. And it's important that we're showing up for them. So my biggest advice is just we need to know our students and we need to make sure that we're having check-ins and conversations with them regularly, not just when something's going wrong.
I tell this story because it's important to me. About 10 years ago, I had a student, thought school went really great.
right? Was doing well. I always tell my kids in my home base, and I always tell their parents, I'm like your mommy at school. I said, I'm not your parent, but like, I'm going to watch you like you're my kid. I'm going to love you like you're my kid. And if you're not getting it done, we're going to have that conversation too, because I care that much about you. And the grades were great. Nothing indicated anything was wrong. 2 weeks before school got out, he just quit coming to school. And his mom showed up the last day to come pick up his stuff from me. And I said, oh, what's going on? You know, like, was he sick? And she's like, no, he doesn't want to come and he doesn't want to be here anymore. And she was, you know, he had some suicidal ideation. And in that moment, it just blew me away, because I thought I had done a fabulous job. And that has really changed, you know, that's really changed how I look at my kids. Do I know every kid? Do I know something about every one of my kids in my home base? You know, could I have a conversation about their life? I am also a big fan of social hour. And I know that sounds ridiculous. And Franny kind of alluded to that too. But I think sometimes we're so focused on hammering through things. And a lot of research will show you, if you look at Jonathan Hattie's, I think the second greatest impactor to student success is relationships, right? They say command of your curriculum or your mastery of your content is number one, right? Knowing your stuff. But number two is relationships with kids. And so if you take the time to build first, the other stuff will happen so much faster. And so I think sometimes we have to remind ourselves to do that, not be so worried about that curriculum right away, make those connections right away, because they are more comfortable, you know? And I think sometimes I get in trouble with my principal because kids will come tell me things that aren't even in my class. You know, Ms. Peterson, this happened today. What are we going to do? Because they know I'm going to do something about it. However, then they're like, why do you know all these things? I'm like, the kids just come because they care enough to want to know. I want them to know that I want to help them. And I think all of our teachers in our building are that way. But sometimes you have to make that effort to go, do I really know that kid?
Many schools in North Dakota are using multi-tiered systems of support. The vernacular is MTSS. For listeners, what does tier one support actually look like in the classroom or the gym? Franny, can you help us begin that conversation?
Absolutely. So, you know, Craig, and I don't know if you know this, but I am the MTSS coordinator at my school, and I love MTSS so much. So I think you and I could have a private conversation outside of this realm. But, you know, I think that the purpose of tier one is to really provide universal supports for our students, right? So we're trying to figure out how can we try and meet all of the students the best for our needs. And I think there's a couple things. I think number one, we need to have create a positive school culture. And I think that that's something that's really easily said. I think it's harder to do. And we need to be really intentional about it. And we need to be very purposeful. And there's lots of conversations that need to happen on a school-wide system. But we just need to try and figure out, how can we celebrate student success? How can we make sure we're designating time to check in on kids? How can we make sure that we're providing students with opportunities to be successful? I think that there needs to be time for social emotional learning. And sometimes, like Sheila was saying, we can worry so much about the content and the curriculum. And sometimes at the end of the day, that's not the first thing that students need. And so we just need to make sure that we're being very purposeful and intentional about how can we help our students be successful and how can we give them opportunities to increase their social and emotional, their needs. And so those would be the top couple things that I think are very important.
Consistency as well. When you get to working, I also have worked in the MTSS. I've worked in the behavioral side of things. And one of the biggest things that we did when we started this process many moons ago was to make sure that we had consistent expectations across the board in all the classrooms. It doesn't necessarily mean that all the rules are the same, but there's some common non-negotiables. And I think that sometimes we run into issues in classrooms when kids don't know what to expect or what your expectations are. And then there gets to be that, well, you did it this way today, and then yesterday you did it that way. And so when you get that confusion about how everybody's going to move, that creates some issues too. But kids, everybody likes to know what to expect, right? So when we have consistency across the board, I think it helps kids so much with just being more calm because they know what to expect. You talked about celebrations, and sometimes people will say, well, why would I celebrate a kid who's doing what they're supposed to be doing? You know, they should just be doing it. Okay, however, if I'm in an evaluation and I'm doing my job, my principal tells me good job, right? If I do a nice job, I win an award, all those things. And so I think sometimes those kids that are just doing what they're supposed to be doing every day get left behind sometimes because you're so focused on the kid who really needs that extensive intervention. And so one nice thing about the tier ones is it doesn't focus about the negative. It's about setting your culture, setting common policy procedure, but also how are you recognizing the good things that are happening? Because we know that, you know, you want to have that 5-to-1 ratio and people respond better to positive. We all do. So what if we flip the way that we were looking at things? What if we targeted how do we have a positive culture versus how do we fix all these problems? Maybe that shifts things a little bit.
Sheila, that just reminds me that I went to a training a couple of years ago, and I wish I could remember who it was that said, it was like one of those like makeshifts where like there's so many different people, but this guy stood up there and he said, the behavior you look for is the behavior you're gonna see. And for me personally, that was life-changing because I was in a very hard classroom that year dealing with a lot of big behaviors. All I felt where I saw the problems. And when I shifted and started looking for the good and commenting and celebrating the good, I saw more of it. And so I think sometimes too, with that tier one support, it's really important to look for all those good things because then we're going to continue to see more of them down the road.
After the break, what happens when there are issues? What moving into tier two or tier three interventions and targeting students who might need support looks like? And we'll talk about that right after this news.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 4, The Seasons of Vivaldi and Piazzolla, March 14th and 15th. This all-strings program features concertmaster Sonia Bosca-Harrison in Vivaldi's Four Seasons and Piazzolla's Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. Details at fmsymphony.org.
Welcome back to Main Street on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're continuing our discussion talking about student mental health and behavioral support and what it looks like day to day in schools right here in North Dakota. My guests are two North Dakota Teachers of the Year, Sheila Peterson. She hails in the Bismarck area, and Franny Tunseth. She works in Mayville, and we're talking about what works and maybe what doesn't work and we need to do better at relative to mental health and behavioral health in our schools. We talked about tier one support, celebrating the great, but now, Franny and Sheila, there are also students that need more targeted support. Moving into the tier two or tier three interventions, verbiage that we don't understand to what that means to help kids who really need some extra support here.
They talk about systems of support, so it's really important that you build that system. You know, what interventions do you have available in tier one? How do you figure out who should be in those tier one interventions? So I think first identifying, right? Like reverse or backwards design. You have to know what are you looking for in each tier. Once you've been able to figure out what you're looking for in each tier, what kind of characteristics would identify a student for that, then you can start looking around and seeing what supports do we have and at what level are we going to give those supports. So at a level one, you know, it's just like we talked about those procedures, those policies, the positive and promoting the positive school culture. When you get to level two, then you're looking at like a check-in, check-out. Right. So how do I check in with a kid every hour of the day? You know, maybe they carry a little sheet of paper around and they come every hour of the day and they check in with every single teacher. They get to make that connection and have those conversations right in the moment before big things happen. Also, you know, at tier two, then you're looking at that you're getting your counselors a little bit more involved. Maybe you're looking at some social groups, things like that, to help build that capacity. You're looking at where's the deficit. It's not what's wrong with the kid, but where's the deficit? Right. So like, what is that piece that the puzzle that we can put back in to help that student be more successful? And then when you're looking at tier three, that a lot of times those interventions are something much greater than what we're able to handle in the school. And that's what you're looking at. You might have school-based mental health. And in our school, we're blessed because of where we're at. But even in our school, you can only have so many students attend school-based mental health, right? Because there's only so much funding for that. And that's a whole nother side conversation. But that's when you're looking at if there's potentially some residential or virtual learning, or it could be like for us, we have what's called Renew Ed. So it's a different place within our district that students can go, much smaller class size. The teacher to student ratio is much smaller. And then there's a lot more targeted interventions. And so what we used to talk about was like a triangle and the triangle flipped, right? And so you're probably, because the triangle is getting bigger at the top because you're adding more and more interventions, right? Everybody's in tier one probably needs very minimal intervention. And then as you look at it, you're building it more interventions into place, depending on what systems you have available in your school. You know, we have family liaisons and all of those things, social workers. So looking at wrapping around the whole part of the child to figure out when you have those deficits, how do we help support them? Sometimes it's a behavioral thing, but like Franny talked about, sometimes it's an economical thing in the family, right? So how can the social worker help them? How can the family liaison help them figuring out transportation or just meeting the, you know, Maslow's basic hierarchy and needs?
Franny, and this is a tougher issue in a smaller community.
I think, Craig, that it gets hard when we're talking about the tier three and trying to talk about outside services for schools, because as a rural school, we have limited access to mental health professionals. We are geographically challenged, right? Like, we don't have these people that are in our communities. And so when we're talking about psychologists, counselors, social workers, psychiatrists, we don't have access to those people. Or if we do, they're often not people that are directly tied into our community. And so that can be really challenging. Students who are on that tier three support specifically often require individual therapy, sometimes some family therapy, sometimes trauma focused counseling, sometimes even psychiatric care. And so without these professions nearby, it's really hard for a school to fully implement tier three interventions well. However, I like to try look at the asset based lens and like, what do we have? And what we do have in rural schools is people that really care. We have people that do their very, very best to try and reach out to different organizations to figure out how we can have these conversations. And sometimes it's offering Zoom therapy sessions inside the school day, during the school day, with professionals that live outside of our community. And I think that that is something that's been very helpful for students. I think another thing that we try to utilize very well is we try really, really hard to tap into like our special education unit. And try and work and partner with them on some of these issues as well, because they sometimes have better resources or better connections than we do at our school. And so I think that there are issues with our tier three supports, but we also need to look at sometimes like, what are the things in our control, right? We can't control who lives in our community. We can't control our access to these people, but what we can control, we need to make sure we're being very intentional about those conversations. And then that transportation and geographic barriers, hard, right? Like if we have a student that needs to go to Grand Forks or to Fargo, and we're asking them to go for those counseling visits, transportation can be really hard for families, right? We have financial burdens of, now I have to pay for gas. Now mom has to ask time off of work to be able to go to this. I'm not able to get in it unless it's during the school day. I mean, those are very hard, you know. Public transportation is very limited or non-existent in a lot of rural schools, which makes it hard for students to attend regularly as well. And then as Sheila was talking about, just that financial and insurance limitations too, right? Sheila's also had talked about the financial things that are hard for families, but I think that that isn't just the things that are happening, that can also lead into insurance limitations. And when you're trying to start to think about, gosh, now I have to pay for a copay and maybe my insurance isn't really good, and now I have to pay for my child to go to counseling, and yes, they need it, but also does that mean I'm taking food off of the table to give my students these services? Like, those are really hard things that parents are having to make decisions about in our rural communities. And they're very real. And I think it needs to be named, because I think we need to try to think of systems. We need to try to think of systems that can help families, and systems that can help students.
To piggyback off of Franny, I think also just that discussion, we talk about barriers and we look at some of the funding. You know, when we got those COVID funds, one of the things that we got in our school is, you talk about the transportation, the money, the insurance. Those are huge barriers for families. Parents want the best for their kids. We want the best for their kids. So being able to afford to bring those people into our, to our schools, you know, so that removes a huge barrier. But you start talking about like changes in Medicaid and the per pupil funding and all of those things make it a lot harder for schools. And we're the center, we're the heart of the community. Hopefully, right? And so how do we, it's not us against parents, it's not, you know, that type of thing. It's like, how do we partner with families? Because if our kids are healthy, our community is going to be healthy.
I want to jump ahead in my notes, belonging and school connection. And Sheila, I want to visit with you initially about this, because it's something that I feel strongly about. I know that research consistently shows that school connectedness is one of the strongest protective factors for mental health. Well, what is that? You're a PE teacher and you're also a coach. Teams and school activities help create that sense of belonging. And I'm worried with specialization of sports, especially, that so many kids are falling out of activities at a younger age, thinking they're not worthy. They don't have the bucks to travel around to who knows where to participate. And in the end, it really costs us at our schools. Sheila, is that something that we should maybe take a closer look at?
Yeah, I think it's a huge concern. And one of the my most favorite things about moving to Bismarck and coaching here in middle school is that we have a rule. Everybody plays equal in middle school. That was the first time in my coaching career that I've ever, from C to the A level, didn't matter in middle school. The belief system is you develop kids because you don't know. You really don't. Somebody sees a second grader who's super developed, right? They mature before everybody else. And we now decide that that is the
the next Michael Jordan, right? Or Caitlin Clark or whatever. And all of a sudden, all these kids go, well, that's never going to be me, right? So then they drop off, they quit. Well, you know, so like I was at my daughter's C team volleyball match a couple years ago, and they were not real great. Okay. And I'm like, got a huge smile on my face because I'm just enjoying being there. And the moms are like, how, because they know I coach, right? And they're like, how are you not upset right now? How are you in the coach? And dada. I said, well, how much practice did your daughter put in? And they're like, well, what do you mean? I said, my daughter showed up the first day of practice. The last time she touched a volleyball was last year at the same time. She's not in volleyball because she's going to be an Olympic athlete. She's there because she's making friends. She's learning how to show up for people. She's learning the importance of having discipline and that the world's bigger than just yourself. And bless that coach's heart, because that was a tough crew, right? And I think we really have to reframe the way that we look at any activity. All activities are good for kids. My daughter's a wrestler. We sat at her banquet last night, and I just sat there so grateful for the things in the 3 years that my daughter's wrestled that she's learned. She's learned to show up when she's tired. She's learned that you got to go to the fundraiser. You got to help the team, right? Because we all have to put in that little bit. It's not just about yourself. Those were things that she didn't learn just from me. I could tell my kid that, but she learns those lessons. And I think that we've got to look at the value in what happens in those moments, especially, you know, if you have good models and good coaches. And the other thing is my gosh, my kid's been in everything. And I remember my husband going, well, she quits everything. And I'm like, well, she didn't like it. So we move on to the next thing. He's like, well, I said, she finishes the season always, correct? And he's like, yeah. I go, you got to learn to finish even if you don't like it. However, it's okay to try new things, and it's okay to be in all the things. And I think sometimes we've really got to, because it's so good for kids' mental health, especially those kids who are athletes, sometimes getting just a breather. I see my kids all the time go, oh, it was so fun to be in the play for a little bit, you know, just to do something completely different. I was a basketball player. I loved to go to track. It was such a leisure sport compared to basketball. And it wasn't that we didn't work hard, right? Just the vibe was just so much more relaxed. And it was good for me to take a season and then get back to it. And I think we put so much pressure on kids to perform at such an early age. It's not fair.
And I think that's key. It is so much earlier than it used to be. Franny, do you have anything to add to that?
I just think we need to have fun, right? Like, I mean, I have kids, like, I mean, my first grader plays hockey, and he absolutely loves it. And the things that he has learned, I don't care if he's winning or losing, but the resiliency that he's learned, the way to persevere, the way that, like, grit is important, right? Those are so important. I think also, Craig, and I had a conversation with a head coach at a local university, at one of our North Dakota universities, and we were having this conversation much like this about how kids are one tracking, and we have a kid that's going into 3-year mini mites, and they are only going to play hockey, and they're going to play hockey year round. It's the only thing they're going to do. And this coach told me he specifically looks for kids that have and play multiple sports because it makes them more well-rounded. And for me as a parent, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so important to know and to realize, and also take a step back and think about what's the big picture in life, right? When you look at how many people turn out to be the Josh Allens in the world, it's not very many of them. But at the end of the day, the things that they're learning in sports, it's bigger than the sport. And they're going to be able to take those things with them in their next jobs, in their communications with friends, in life. And so I just think it's really important to make sure that we as schools and as communities are being very intentional about making sure that we have opportunities for all kids to see themselves in these activities first. And then number two, making sure they stay.
I think we undervalue the importance of resilience and yes. The correlation between anxiety, depression, right? And so one of the things I've really tried to identify for even my own children, like, how do I build resilience? That's like, out of all the things that she gets from her sports or anything, I want her to become a resilient human being. Because once you know you can do a tough thing, you know that the rain will fall and then the sun will come again, right? But a lot of that is missing right now, is that resilience and even the stamina to struggle.
I love this conversation. I want to turn it back to the academic part of your world. And Franny, I want to start with you here. You have students, I'm sure, who have repeatedly, maybe for years, struggled with the academic portions of their school requirements. How do you rebuild confidence while still maintaining expectations?
Yes. Well, Craig, my first thing is that I firmly believe that all kids can and will succeed. And that success might look different depending upon who the student is. But when they are in my classroom, we are going to succeed and we're still going to have high expectations. And so the first thing that we do is we look at what are the expectations. We look at this grade level standards. We look at what students are expected to do. And then we break apart the different steps to make sure that it is manageable for them to get there. But you're right. I have students that come to me that learning is hard. And I think it's important to note to state that, like, learning can be hard. And I talk to them all the time. I'm like, you guys, you know what? Jesus did not give me any geography skills. Like, geography is hard for me. I don't know if I'm facing north, south, east, or west at all. I actually tell my husband north is where I'm always going. And he's like, that's not how it works. But I think that just sharing those real life struggles with kids and letting them know there are areas that as adults we struggle with too. Number one, makes you human, which is really important. Number two, it makes your classroom a safe space. So when students know that your classroom is a safe space, they're more willing to have those conversations and tell you when learning gets hard. But I think too, my goal as an MTSS or interventionist is to make sure that I have students see themselves as learners and see themselves as successful learners. And so it really is building that confidence, which is why I think it goes back to the importance of celebrating kids, the importance of naming our growth, the importance of showcasing this is where you are and now here's where you are. And we're gonna take those bite-sized pieces and we're gonna celebrate every piece along the way. Because if we look at a ladder, and my kids laugh at me when I bring out the ladder analogy, but if you bring out a ladder and if you only have the first step and then the very top step, that is scary. I can't reach that. But if you just say, hey, we're going to climb one little ladder step today, it's doable, it's manageable, and it can happen. And so I think that for me, this is an area that I'm very passionate about and I get really excited about. But I think that we just need to realize, number one, that all kids can succeed, but it's our job as educators to make sure we have the right environments and the right supports to help them succeed. Sheila, what would you add to that?
Well, you know, we're on the south side of Bismarck, so we just got a little grid down here. So when somebody tells me I can, it's I can, but I'm having troubles. I have that conversation all the time. And I love you enough to have high expectations for you. And it's just that growth mindset all the time, you know. And I always tell my kids, if somebody doesn't question you when you know, I'm a physical educator. And so we don't have a lot of writing assignments. But when we do, I return it back. I'm like, you got to keep doing it until it's an A. Oh my gosh, PD, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. Why would I make you do something that I didn't want you to be successful at? And yeah. Guess what? I'm going to walk alongside you because I shouldn't give you work if I didn't want you to master it. So if you ever have an adult that gives you a sheet of paper and allows you to turn in garbage, you should be mad that you had to do it in the first place. You know, we all care about you enough. I know you're mad at me right now because you had to miss trench ball so that we could work on your goal setting assignment, because I know you need to write goals when you're an adult. Right? And make lots of money and do all the amazing things. So I'm going to sit with you and we're going to do this. And I know you're mad at me, but I love you that much.
As we leave our discussion today, and Sheila, let me start with you. Franny, you can end it up. If you could give parents, caregivers, or community members one practical thing they can do right now to support the mental health and well-being of young people, what would you leave us with?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Jonathan Haidt. And during my Teacher of the Year, I was trying to get as many people to read that book as possible. So if I was a parent, I would tell them, please read that book. One of the most favorite things that I write about in that book, that kind of encompasses what we want to build in kids, the stamina, the high expectations, you know, the resilience, the grit. But he talked about don't interrupt your kids when they're doing dangerous things safely. So like, give them the space to try it. Give them, you know, you can watch from afar, make sure they're okay. But like, let them experience some of those struggles. Support, I always call it supported struggle, right? Let them experience them that a little bit. And when they find those struggles and they're upset, come back with an I wonder. When you know what the answer is, to say to that kid, well, I wonder what would happen if, and let them start to work through it with you. But give them those supported struggles. It's one of the best things you can do.
Franny?
Yeah, you know, Craig, the first thing that's in my heart, and so I'm just gonna go with my gut, is I think it's just so important to build strong, trusting relationships that have like that consistent, open, and empathetic communication. And then when something doesn't feel right, connect with the school. Because as teachers too, we wanna be able to help our administration, our counselors, our teachers. And if we don't know that something's happening, we can't help throughout the school day. And we have these kids for a long period of time. So I think that at home, what you can do is make sure that they can talk to you, make sure you have those conversations with kids and that you're creating a safe space for them. But then when something is happening, reach out to the school to get further help and figure out how we can partner together to support students during the entire day.
My thanks to Sheila Peterson and Franny Tunseth for this great conversation about what student mental health and behavioral support really looks like in schools, building trust teaching expectations and responding to trauma with skill and the connections that kids need to help. North Dakota has structures in place from school-based coordinators and technical assistance supported by grant funding, but we heard today that it's relationships that really matter. And we did mention suicide. There's immediate help available if you or anyone you know is considering suicide or self-harm. Please call 988. Help is available 24/7. To both of you, thank you so much for visiting with us today on Main Street.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here, Craig.
Thank you.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, stay with us. Next on Prairie Public, it's All Things Considered from NPR. Childcare now costs more than a mortgage, rent, and even a college tuition in many places. New York City's mayor is proposing universal daycare, and the idea is gaining national attention. We'll take a look at the growing push to help parents with the cost of care. That's next on All Things Considered here on Prairie Public. And tonight at 8 p.m. Central, it's The Hidden Brain. Ever wonder why some people seem magnetic? What makes someone truly charismatic? Charm? Confidence? Something deeper? We'll explore the science of charisma tonight on Hidden Brain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 9th. March in North Dakota signals the coming of spring, the last gasps of winter, and basketball. High school teams across the state battle through the regular season, with successful squads earning trips to the district tournaments and hoping to secure a spot in the state tournament to compete for the title of best in the state. A century ago, the High School League, predecessor of today's North Dakota High School Activities Association, determined the pairings for the 1926 tournament using a different method than in previous years. In prior seasons, tournament pairings were set using the same method as at the district level, which meant teams didn't know who they would play until the day the tournament began. That led to frustration and nervousness among fans and players who were unsure of their opponents or the travel involved. In 1926, the league board drew pairings by district, allowing the tournament field to be announced sooner and giving players and fans more time to prepare. Another major difference between 1926 and today, the high school league had just one class in basketball, compared to three classes today. The 1926 pairings were set. Devil's Lake faced Fargo at 2:30 on Friday, March 19th, followed by Mandan versus Minot at 3:30. The evening session featured Valley City against Grand Forks at 7:30, followed by Donnybrook battling Dickinson at 8:30. Fargo defeated Dickinson 28-27 to claim the state championship. The tournament was held in the state training school gym, described at the time as the best in the state. The basketball landscape has changed dramatically over the past 100 years, with school closures, consolidations, and population growth in major cities. Grand Forks, Fargo, and Minot now each have more than one high school and compete in Division AA along with Dickinson and Mandan. Valley City and Devil's Lake compete in different regions of Division A. Donnybrook no longer has a high school or its own team, closing its doors and consolidating with Kenmare in 1987. March brings the close of basketball season in North Dakota and the crowning of state champions. Schools and communities cheer on their teams and hope for success. It's an exciting time for fans, young and old, to make memories and reflect on past accomplishments. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwein. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
And that wraps up today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, at just 38, a young Fargo resident thought fatigue and abdominal pain were nothing serious, but what it brought about was an unexpected colon cancer diagnosis. The courageous story of Billy Kitzman tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.